This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Democracy North, a weekly roundup of the top interviews and headlines from our daily Media Morning show here at Media Mornings. Find us at w2media.ca/thisweek. On today's show, we're broadcasting live from the heart of Vancouver's downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories. Our week's top headlines here gathered by our team of producers and interviewers covering the week's top grassroots Canadian and global news. On today's show, we're very excited to present renowned Indian author Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things and her latest book, Capitalism, A Ghost Story. She was interviewed exclusive by us in her hotel room on a recent visit to Vancouver. Also this week, the Canada Health Accord has expired, raising many fears from people about the future of healthcare in Canada. We speak with the NDP's health critic, Libby Davies, as well as someone from Canadian Doctors for Medicare about what this means for us. All these and more, plus this week's top news headlines coming right up. Stay tuned. Thank you for listening.
Weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
And now I'll be right back with this week's top news headlines from across Canada and around the world. In our top story this week, Mayor Rob Ford's friend Alexander Lisi threatened people in the Dixon Road community that they would all be killed if the crack video of him was not turned over. That's according to new documents ordered released by a judge. But as the Toronto Star reports, the Lisi was told people in the community, "You're effing dead and everyone on your block is dead." According to conversations caught on a wiretap the May 17th morning that the news broke about the existence of the video of Mayor Ford smoking crack cocaine and making racist and homophobic comments. The comments were made during a call between two people, Lee Ben Sayed and Warsan Hussein. According to the men and others caught in the wiretap during the day, Lisi made a series of threats beginning immediately after news of the video surfaced. He said, quote, "If that video gets released, I'm gonna run through your houses, me and all the Toronto police." Last May, Toronto police were intercepting telephone calls to numbers owned by suspected members of Guns and Drugs gang being investigated by the Project Traveler Squad. And in other news, Healthcare Accord of Canada had expired on Monday. And Roy Romano, former NDP Premier of Saskatchewan and one-time chair of the Royal Commission on the Future of Healthcare, said it was a sad day for healthcare in Canada. According to the Toronto Star, the day that marked the end of the Health Council of Canada and the 10-year health accord that led to its creation. He said it's a blow to nation building because it's a blow to one of our revered, if not most revered, social programs, which is Medicare, Romano said. The 2004 accord was a joint creation of the federal, provincial, and territorial governments. It was intended to force reforms and set national standards in areas such as primary care, wait lists, and electronic health records, with strings attached to $41 billion in federal transfers and council acting as a watchdog. The accord has been replaced with a funding scheme created unilaterally by the federal government. But with no conditions attached, critics charged Ottawa has abdicated its role in shaping the direction of the health system. We'll be hearing more about some of these changes later on today's program with Libby Davies, the NDP's health critic, as well as someone from Canadian Doctors for Medicare. In news here in BC, BC Premier Christy Clark's transit policies and her push for a referendum on transit, as well as her support for Enbridge on given five conditions that are met by Alberta and the federal government, are being questioned now after revelations that she worked directly on contract for TransLink in her ex-husband's lobby firm before returning to politics. That firm also lobbied for Enbridge. Burrard Communications owner Mark Marison told 24 Hours that his ex-wife's role for TransLink was only a few community meetings and not lobbying. But Duff Conacher of Democracy Watch said a perceived conflict exists and she should be prohibited from dealing with TransLink issues. Marison confirmed Clark was listed as a partner in Burrard Communications during a brief 2006 contract with TransLink between her time in the legislature and her return as premier. Two people previously employed as federally registered lobbyists for the company have close ties to Christy Clark, one of them her executive assistant before she quit politics and after her re-election, and the other became an assistant deputy minister for strategic planning and public engagement. The news broke after the Vancouver Observer obtained a Burrard internal file showing Clark was listed as a full partner in the firm, which prior to her time there lobbied for Enbridge, proponent of the controversial Northern Gateway pipeline. Now, down to Venezuela, where a powerful 7.6 magnitude earthquake rocked northern Chile just 24 hours after an 8.2 tremor killed six people, destroyed 2,600 houses, and led to mass evacuations. A tsunami alert in Chile and Peru was again issued, but later lifted after waves were less than a meter tall. The first waves hit within 45 minutes of the quake, Chilean officials said, adding that the disaster forced evacuations along Chile's Pacific coast for fear of a tsunami. As Al Jazeera and BBC reported, thousands of buildings lost power and hundreds of thousands of Chileans are spending the night away from their homes due to evacuation orders. Chilean President Michelle Bachelet declared parts of northern Chile hit by the earthquake to be disaster zones and issued tsunami warnings throughout the Pacific coast. In Alberta, as health concerns stir explosive passions among opponents and defenders of the oil sands, a new Alberta Energy Regulator report finds that emissions from the multi-billion dollar industry may be causing significant health woes in the northwest of the province. As the Vancouver Observer reports, the industry-funded agency spent months hearing from residents and experts about the toxic, smelly fumes from the Peace River oil sands region, about 500 kilometers northwest of Edmonton. It concluded Monday that emissions have the potential to hurt local families. Farmer Alain Labrec, his wife Carla, and two small children found the fumes so painful they abandoned their home and province in search of a safer community in Smithers, B.C. Other families have fled the Reno areas, and dozens more in a wider Peace River region have also complained about the fumes from oil sands. Local heavy operators were told to, quote, eliminate venting, reduce flaring, and ultimately conserve all produced gas where feasible, according to the report. The Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers said the energy regulator's findings are a company-specific issue and declined to say more. In Nunavut, musician Tanya Tagak showed her support for the Inuit seal hunt last week by posting a seal fee on her Twitter account, part of a growing trend in defense when after Ellen DeGeneres donated the proceeds from her Oscar selfie to the Humane Society of USA, which is opposed to Inuit seal hunting. Members of the Inuit community, however, are shocked by a backlash that Tagak and others received, and more than she could possibly imagine. The pictures showed people sporting traditional sealskin clothing, and on March 28, Tagak posted her own tweet showing her baby beside a dead adult seal beside her home in Cambridge Bay, Nunavut. But in an interview with CBC News, Tagak said she was shocked by the reaction to the photo, which was, quote, quite hurtful. One woman even launched a petition to have Tagak's baby removed from her. Others, however, have showed their support for the award-winning singer. In federal conservative news, Mississauga MP Eve Adams stands accused of abusing the Conservative Party and the Commons resources in her bid to grab a new seat, of insulting and bullying board members in the new riding, and threatening the Riding Association's 2015 election plans. But as the Toronto Star reports, it may be news to her that her December tantrum over a $6 car wash at an Ottawa gas station will turn out to be her political career tipping point. A conservative supporter and owner of the Island Park Esso, John Newcomb, in Ottawa's West End, said he contacted the Prime Minister's office in January to complain about an incident with Adams in December. He said that she was so upset about the car wash she felt was unsatisfactory, parked directly in front of a pump lane at the busy station, blocking traffic behind it on a busy Ottawa street. Those alleged bullying tactics led to scrutiny of her bid for the Conservative nomination in the new Oakville North Burlington riding. Adams also denied inappropriate actions in her push for the Conservative nomination, and yet Prime Minister Stephen Harper has now ordered an investigation by the party's National Council into her behavior. It all comes just days after Harper fired Adams' fiancé, Dimitri Sudas, as executive director of the Conservative Party over meddling in the riding on her behalf, contrary to Sudas' employment contract. Down in the U.S., a gunman opened fire Wednesday at the Fort Hood military base in an attack that left four people dead, including the shooter, at the same post where more than a dozen people were killed in a 2009 mass shooting. A U.S. law enforcement official said the shooter died of what appeared to be a self-inflicted wound. Over to Syria, where at least 150,000 people have been killed in this three-year-old civil war, sparked by the Arab Spring Uprising and a crackdown on protesters. A third of those are civilians, according to the UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. But as The Guardian reports, many of the deaths are of Syrian rebels, including fighters from Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, roughly 40,000. More than 58,000 pro-Assad fighters were also killed, including security forces and militia. In climate news, Arctic sea ice remained on its death spiral Wednesday, and the amount of winter ice cover failing its fifth lowest on satellite record, according to scientists. The scientists said the Arctic ice has reached the extent of 4.8 million square kilometers, almost its lowest ever. The world's leading scientists this week admitted Arctic sea ice was disappearing faster than expected. This news comes just as the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its much-anticipated report, saying that unless governments act now to reduce emissions, no one will be safe from the effects of climate change. According to the game-changing report from the UN's panel, it is vulnerable and marginalized groups who will feel the brunt of climate change and its effects, but the whole world's food system could be imperiled, and focus on this might be able to sway undecided people to take action. Meanwhile, AP reports that ExxonMobil, the world's largest oil giant, said that no matter what policies are put in place for climate change, it is highly unlikely to stop it from selling fossil fuels far into the future. Well, that is our news for this week on Democracy North. Next up, we have an exclusive interview with Arundhati Roy. She sat down with Derek O'Keefe and Jahanzeb Hossain. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, on CHLY Radio Nanaimo, on the Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. Now, award-winning author Arundhati Roy, author of the novel The God of Small Things and her latest book, Capitalism, A Ghost Story, sat down with Media Morning's own hosts, Derek O'Keefe and Jahanzeb Hossain, earlier this week to talk about her trip to Vancouver, as well as her analysis on the state of global capitalism and politics in India and worldwide. Here, we're going to play part one of her interview, sit down in her hotel room, actually, tomorrow Derek and Jahanzeb will play the rest of it, but here is part one, Arundhati Roy in conversation in her hotel room this week.
Hi, this is Derek O'Keefe of Media Mornings. We're here with Arundhati Roy, who on Tuesday evening is doing her first ever talk in Vancouver. Arundhati, of course, is an acclaimed novelist, nonfiction writer, won many accolades for The God of Small Things, and her latest book just out from Haymarket is Capitalism, A Ghost Story. Arundhati, we wanted to start on this title. What is the ghost in the story of global capitalism these days, or the ghosts, plural?
Well, it started out, my thinking about the idea of it being a ghost story started out because I start this essay by standing outside the gates of this 27-story skyscraper in Bombay that is the most expensive dwelling ever built of Mukesh Ambani, who's the richest man in India, who runs Reliance India Limited. And it has, you know, floors of parking and 900 servants and all of that. After they actually built it, they didn't move into it because they started to believe it was haunted. And so, that really somehow summed it up for me in some ways, what was happening in India. And I was standing there looking at this building, which had a 27-story high vertical lawn on one side, and bits of the lawn had fallen off. And I said, it looks like trickle down hadn't worked, but that had, because in India, 100 people own the equivalent of 25% of the GDP, and then it gets into the whole debate about how capitalism in India, which is, in some ways, what is happening there is a concise version of what has happened in Europe and America in the past, which is that you have a country which is poised on the edge of wanting to claim itself to be an economic superpower. But unlike, Europe and America, it didn't have, America itself was a colony, but it, in some ways, it colonized, the Native Americans. But India is colonizing itself, and so you have an elite that has sort of seceded into outer space where it looks down on the land and says, looks at the bauxite and the iron ore and the water and the forests in which villagers and indigenous people live, and it just says, what's our bauxite doing in their mountains, and what's our water doing in their rivers? And there is this war that has been unleashed, mm-hmm. And that's what it's about. And how do they work? How does to extract that? It's an economy of extraction, but to extract that raw material, it can send in the army or send in the paramilitary or send in the air force, which it's used to doing. I mean, India is a country that since 1947, when it became independent, there has not been a single day or a single year where the Indian army has not been deployed against, quote-unquote, its own people. It's been at war in Manipur, in Nagaland, in Kashmir, in Punjab, in Junagadh, in Hyderabad, I mean, whatever. So it's not... But the war from the edges is sort of moving into the heartland now. And they can use the army for against the poor. There are thousands of people in jail now in those areas, charged with sedition and so on for opposing government infrastructure projects. How do they deal with the, how do they deal with the middle class? How do they deal with other thinking people, through sort of co-opting them? First of all, by redesigning their minds in university, but then by these mining companies are now running literature festivals and film festivals and slowly brainwashing people into buying into that project.
So it's a cultural project as well.
It's a cultural project, an intellectual project, and on the other hand, a communal project. So. Basically, what happened is that, in the late 80s and the early 90s, when Soviet communism lost its war in the mountains of Afghanistan, India, which had been aligned with the Soviet Union, basically realigned itself with the U.S. and Israel and so on. And from being a regulated economy, it opened its markets to international finance. And simultaneously, it opened the lock, like I said, it opened the lock on the market, and it opened the lock of this 14th century mosque called the Babri Masjid, which had been a disputed site because Hindus said that, the Lord Ram had been born there. And so it opening these two locks ushered in two kinds of conflict. One was the conflict which came from economic totalitarianism, the free market, and all of that, and the other, the rise of what we now call Hindutva, Hindu fundamentalism. And both these conflicts created, manufactured two kinds of terrorists, the Islamist terrorist and the Maoist terrorist. You know, they were just concepts. And whether it was the ruling, whether it was the Congress that was in power or the more right-wing BJP that was in power, they both jockeyed and, you know, gave these two kinds of terrorisms different priorities, but used it to militarize and further militarize and further militarize, you know.
In terms of militarization, the Canadian government is looking at starting to sell weapons to India. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, they haven't allowed Canadian arms manufacturers to sell to India, but the Canadian government, increasingly, like the U.S., closer and closer ties with India in general. I wonder why now, on the verge of the BJP's return to power in India, why do Western leaders like Stephen Harper, who are always touting the danger of Islamism, how come they're never talking about Hindu fascism or the far-right nationalism and the danger it poses? Why is the West so...
Especially in a so-called democracy, in a so-called biggest democracy in the world with a parliamentary system, there's a rise of religious nationalism or fundamentalism, especially that as well. Because it's usually connected with failed states or Muslim countries, but not really the democracies.
Well, the reason that nobody talks about the rise of Hindu fascism is because the rise of Hindu fascism is concurrent with the rise of the Indian market, you know, so... Mm. When you have a marketplace of potentially 1 billion people, you're not going to get all that critical. You're not going to worry about the fine points. I mean, I would be curious to know, you know, how come the fact that you live in a country where 3,000 Sikhs could be just massacred on the streets in 84, or thousands of Muslims could be massacred and gang raped and burned alive on the streets of Gujarat. It doesn't count for much. Of course, the American government did ban Modi from coming to the U.S. for a while, but you know, now of course the ban, I think, is almost going to be revoked. I mean, I don't care either way, you know, whether he's allowed to come or not, because you know, he's not got the. He doesn't own the idea of mass killing, you know, so Americans have done plenty of it, so have Canadians. So that's okay, that's their internal business of mass murderers. We can't get involved with it.
Right.
But
on the subject of travel bans, we were almost concerned that the Canadian government might not let you in, even though you're coming with all these mainstream sponsors and the India Festival, just because they've banned a number of intellectuals and politicians who have views that they disagree with and been very crude about it. So we're happy you made it to Vancouver.
So talking about the Gujarat massacre in particular, Modi was able to mobilize the Dalits against Muslims as well. Mm. So how did he manage to do that? What does it say about the relations between different marginalized communities inside India?
Well, I don't know if you've read my introduction to Ambedkar's Annihilation of Caste, in which I talk about this particular aspect. It's a little bit problematic, you know, because, that is the common trope, you know, that a lot of Dalits were involved in killing of Muslims. It happened in the time of partition too. But in this case, there is some studies that show that actually where Dalits and Muslims were living together, there wasn't any trouble, you know. So Dalits are also used as a fallback, you know, that you create the trouble when somebody has to be arrested. The majority of them will be Dalits. But this has a long history. The mobilization of Dalits by Hindutva forces, and you know, in just before partition, this happened a lot in places like Naukali and so on. Because that is the constituency that the Hindutva had been trying to woo, and you know, one of the ways of saying, "Oh, you're also a Hindu. Why don't you do some killing for us?" You know. But it's complicated because they are not always successful, and then it's also difficult for Dalits because they're the ones who take the rap in the end. You know, when Modi decides to be take off his saffron robes and put on his sharp business suit and act and hug the Muslims and say that, oh, you know, I've taken action against people who have been involved in the action will be taken against Dalits for the most part, except for a few show trials, you know.
And also, since the evidence against Modi is quite overwhelming, how come the courts in India haven't been able to do anything about it?
Because they don't want to.
They don't want
you
to?
Know, you can't deal with people like Modi with legal cases and so on, you know. It's something much bigger. It'll just valorize him more, you know, unless they had done it way back in the day. Now, I mean, now the sad fact is that when, say, many years ago, Telka had done a sting operation where the killers of the Muslims actually came out and boasted about how they had killed, how they had raped, how many they had raped. And that expose served to bolster Modi in the elections. People said, wow, you know, let's vote for him because he is a killer. Some people, I'm saying. It's a complicated country and he hasn't managed to just walk away from that past. And we still don't know what's going to happen in the elections. But he used it when he needed to. You know, the thing about India is you call it a democracy, but as elections approach, it's killing season. You know, that's when their people are trying to create their constituencies and commit murder in order to strengthen, you know, the idea of us versus them. And so in 2002, just before the Gujarat elections, Modi was actually losing ground in the municipal elections. And then after this, he came roaring back, you know. And now the same thing has been done in UP, in Muzaffarnagar, you know. And the people, the two politicians who created the massacres of the Muslims, and hundreds of thousands have been driven from their villages. Their land has been taken over by Hindus. And the Muslims are living in ghettos and concentration camps. They have no means of survival. And the people who did it have been given BJP tickets. It was all about elections.
Could I ask, I guess, a little different tack, but you had a very successful novel. I'm sure many people, and you're working on another one, I understand. But there must have been various pressures on you to just write another fictional piece, rather than to take these very strong political stands on Kashmir, on the Naxalite rebellion in India. Why did you feel motivated to do that, despite the huge commercial success that was there for you? I mean, why have you felt the need to do this kind of writing these past 12, 15 years? I don't mean to treat it as a curiosity, like the New York Times piece was the not-so-reluctant rebel or something. Yeah. Like, it shouldn't be that unusual that a successful novelist then turns her skills to these topics, but it is still unusual, I guess. So why did you do this?
Well, look, I never wrote my novel in order to be successful or in order to be rich. I wrote my novel because I had to do, you know, I had a novel to write, and it was never my intention to move from one success to the next, you know, and have people throwing flowers at me. No, I've never had, you know, my life charted out and this is what I want to do. And so it's not as though before I wrote The God of Small Things, I had written, you know, political stuff. Like I'd written essays on the Bandit Queen called The Great Indian Rape Trick. And you know, the climate suddenly changed also in India. Suddenly the BJP came to power, this raw, you know, filthy language of nationalism began. Everything suddenly changed, and I couldn't see myself just, you know, whether I wanted it or not, I was being bandied about as the brand of New India, you know, along with Sachin Tendulkar and Miss World and Arundhati Roy. So, you know, in order to, I had to step out of that hoop and say, look, thanks, but no thanks. I'm not with this project, you know. And then, you know, beginning to write just led me on a journey from one thing to the next. And I think together the essays really not just random individual what people call issues, you know.
Sure.
They are about a worldview. They are connected. They look, they're a way of of setting out another way of looking at the world.
And also, there's a famous quote of yours, another world is possible. Well, it's not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. Mm. So where is the optimism coming from in 2014 when you look at the Arab Spring, drowned in blood, Hindu right in India, the Taliban running riot in Pakistan, the rise of Al-Qaeda again in the Middle East. So where do you see the optimism?
Well, I think my book, Field Notes on Democracy, is dedicated to those who divorced hope from reason, you know. So I think let me say this, that before 9/11, didn't you get the sense that it was very hard work to make people understand what was going on? Now people understand fully what's going on. The problem is what to do about it, you know. But I think it's a great achievement, that not my achievement, I'm just saying generally a collective achievement, that the clarity of seeing the world and seeing American policy and Al-Qaeda and geopolitics and globalization. I mean, 10, 12 years ago, I remember when I was writing on privatization, people in India were saying, take her to a psychiatrist, she's crazy, you know. The fact is that there is a wisdom among people now, on the street, I think, you know. But in places like in India, for instance, it's, you know, while it's very depressing to when you read the papers, if you actually look at it from another point of view, the poorest people in the world have managed to stop the richest corporations in their tracks. Why is Narendra Modi being backed by the corporations right now? All the corporations, Tata, Adani, Reliance, he is being backed by them because they see him as a man who doesn't blink in the face of bloodshed. That, you know, what he did in Gujarat, whatever your moral issues may be, for the corporations, they see him as the man who's going to send the army into Chhattisgarh, to send the Air Force in, deal with the, what they call, overground supporters, activists, journalists, you know, shut them down, open those forests up to the mining corporations, you know. But that is because from 2004, when all those MOUs were signed with the corporations, to 2014, there's been such a... they have not been able to actualize them because of resistance. Because people have got the number, you know. People understand what is going on, what NGOs are up to, what co-optation is, what the literary festivals are doing, what the film festivals are doing, what the corporations are doing, what the intellectuals are doing. The picture is pretty clear in some ways. But how the media is owned, how it works... But along with that understanding has come an increased surveillance, increased militarization, increased prisons filling up, increased custodial deaths. But, I mean, if you question me rationally and inexorably rationally, I can't tell you where the optimism is. But as I said, I think it's just in one's DNA, you know.
Well, your writing has certainly given a lot of people hope, and actually, at Jack Layton's funeral, Stephen Lewis included in the eulogy, he concluded the eulogy to Jack Layton, NDP leader, you know, was not a perfect progressive leader, but it was very much mourned by people in Canada. The eulogy ended with that quote of yours about another world, that you could hear her breathing. So
it's optimism of the soul, I guess.
Yeah.
And we need writers to regenerate that optimism and that hope.
There isn't any point in being pessimistic, right? Rationally, what's the point in being pessimistic? Where will that get us?
Well, thank you very much for your time today, and we're very happy that you're here in Vancouver for first ever talk, and hope you'll consider coming back. It's a nice place to visit. I hope you'll find.
If you keep organizing the sunshine, I'll be back.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Arundhati Roy here on Media Mornings.
And that was Arundhati Roy, celebrated author of God of Small Things, talking about her new book. Capitalism, a Ghost Story, with Media Morning's own Friday hosts, Derek O'Keefe and Jehanzeb Hussain. We'll be right back with Libby Davies, Member of Parliament for Vancouver East and the NDP's health critic, to talk about the latest in Medicare. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, on CHLY Radio Nanaimo, on the Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. Well, joining us on the line here on Media Mornings, Vancouver Co-op Radio, we have Libby Davies. She's MP for Vancouver East, as well as the NDP's health critic, and she's here to talk about the expiration of the Canada Health Accord, a major agreement between the provinces, territories, and federal government to improve the health of Canadians. And here to talk about the NDP's approach to that is Libby. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Welcome so much to Media Mornings. Great to have you here.
Yeah, I'm very pleased to be on the show.
Well, we're reaching you in Ottawa, I believe, and you're running between
lots of
committee meetings. Tell us a little bit, just break down, what is the Health Accord and what happened this week?
Well, the Health Accord was an agreement set up by the government, the provinces, and the territories in 2004, and it set out a funding formula for 10 years, and with some agreed-to objectives and goals about how to improve the healthcare system. Now, I have to say that the Health Accord that came in 2004, it wasn't that great. It was really a whole bunch of money with no strings attached. Nevertheless, there were commitments made by the premiers and the federal government to do things like have better primary care, have better access to doctors, electronic health records, to decrease waiting times for things like knee surgery and hip surgery. Now, what's happened over that 10 years is that, particularly since the Conservative government was elected, they basically walked away from healthcare, and so the federal role has really diminished. To now, it's almost non-existent. So that health accord that you just spoke about, it actually expired on Monday. And the Health Council of Canada that oversaw the accord and sort of monitored improvements that were meant to be taking place, things like better drug coverage. I mean, many Canadians, one of the biggest costs in healthcare is paying for very expensive prescription drugs. We could be doing that a lot better by bulk buying. So a lot of these things haven't happened, primarily because the federal government walked away from the table. So right now, we're kind of in a vacuum. We have no health agreement. The Conservative government unilaterally decided on health care funding. It's really shortchanged a lot of the provinces. And so the changes that need to take place in our health care system to improve our public health care system, things like home care, universal drug coverage, better wait times for different kinds of surgeries, there's a huge question mark. I'm very proud to say that the NDP, we have done a lot of consultation across the country, and we have developed sort of a roadmap of what we think Medicare, what it should go to now and in the future, sort of call it Medicare 2.0. So I'm very proud that we did that. But right now, we have a Conservative government that's pretty well abandoned its role in really what is a very important Canadian social program, and that's our public health care system.
Now, on Monday, you actually were the first out the gate in question period, which doesn't happen very often, but you were the very first person to challenge the government, and you took on the health accord issue and said, asked Minister Ambrose, the health minister, mm-hmm. how she planned to deal with public emergencies, given this, as you said, walking away from the table, as you put it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. It was our lead question on Monday, and in fact, a week prior to that, David, we had questions every single day on healthcare in the House to focus attention on the fact that this health accord was coming to a close. And of course, the minister's response was a familiar pattern from this Conservative government, and that is basically, it's not our problem. It's the provinces. Go deal with them. And they, you know, as I said, they made this unilateral decision about healthcare funding. There was no negotiation. But I know that in Canada, they expect the federal government to be at the table. They want to see improvements. They want to see a drug plan. They want to see, you know, national standards for continuing care. I mean, a lot of folks are dealing with huge issues around aging parents and worrying about home care or whether or not there's an appropriate long-term care facility. Palliative care. We just had a debate in the House the other day on palliative care. So these are really big issues that people are facing in their lives. And for the federal government to basically say, well, you know, we don't really care about this. It's not our jurisdiction. First of all, that's a failed response in terms of jurisdiction. And secondly, it's really, I think, doing the exact opposite of what Canadians want to see. So we've been really pushing it. And I have to say that the consensus across the country from groups like the Canadian Health Coalition, the BC Health Coalition, the nurses, even the doctors, the Canadian Medical Association, is huge around what needs to be done. There's a very strong consensus. So it's, you know, the problem is not knowing what needs to be done. The problem has been a failure in leadership, and I actually hope this will become an issue in the federal election when it comes up in 2015, because I think, you know, people care about it that much. We, you know, this threat of privatization of our healthcare system, we've seen that in BC with the day clinic, and we've, you know, there's a court case underway. So, you know, we have to make sure that our public healthcare system under the Canada Health Act, which is federal legislation, not only survives, but it actually gets better.
A couple years ago, when the premiers of the provinces were meeting to talk about health in Victoria, I forget when that was, like 2011 maybe?
It was 2012.
Very early winter 2012, and yeah, right. I sat down and interviewed Maud Barlow, who talked about not only, you know, defending the system, but how we've lost sight as a country of what it was intended to be in terms of the, you know, the lack of dental or pharmaceutical coverage was only a stopgap to get that in when it first started, and those were always supposed to be part of it, and yet we've kind of narrowed it down to defending these kind of not very exciting, rather boring sort of accord format things instead of expanding it. Could you talk a little bit about that? Do you agree with Maud?
Absolutely. In fact, I was there in Victoria with Maud, to witness the Premier's meeting on healthcare. And, you know, when Tommy Douglas started Medicare in this country 50 years ago, the first phase of Medicare, he always said, was to make sure that people had access to doctors and hospitals with no charge. But he always said there's phase two, and phase two was much more difficult, but it needed to be done. And that was dealing with the other health services that are required and to bring that into the system and to talk about health promotion and disease prevention, or what we sort of call today the social determinants of health. These are things we're tackling in terms of the NDP. It's very much part of the plan that we put out just last Monday. But in terms of the health accord, there was some reference to those questions, David, particularly in terms of drug coverage and home care. These were two things that were actually singled out by Mr. Romano and the Royal Commission on Healthcare in 2002. Well, here we are, 2014, 12 years later, and really we've not made any progress on the question. So, again, this has become a very political question in terms of why we're lagging so far behind on the commitments that are being made. We can't leave it to the premiers and do some stuff together, but really it does require the federal government to be showing that leadership. And again, I want to emphasize that the consensus across the country in terms of advocacy groups, nurses, doctors, healthcare professionals is extraordinary
in terms of
what needs to be done.
That's all our time for today, Libby, but I want to say really thank you for joining us here on Media Mornings and hope to have you on again.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks for calling in. That was Libby Davies, MP for Vancouver East and NDP's National Health Critic.
Well, now we're going to play some music by Tegan and Sarah, their hit song, Close, Come a Little Closer, Closer. It won a Juno as a top single of the year last night at the Junos.
You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, on CHLY Radio Nanaimo, on the Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. I'm David Ball, your host for this week.
And that was a little bit of Tegan and Sarah's Closer, winner at last night's Juno Awards. So the current health accord expires March 31st, and that is today, and the federal government is refusing to renegotiate it. Expiration of the accord will result in a $36 billion cut to public health care and an additional $16.5 billion cut to health care equalization payments. On the line, we have Rachel Tutt of the BC Health Coalition. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Jane.
How are you this morning?
Oh, it's early, but I'm up. I'm here.
That's great. So maybe we can start before starting to talk about some of the actions that are taking place. If you could explain exactly what the Health Accord is. I know a lot of people don't know.
Sure. Yeah, the Health Accord is an agreement, negotiated agreement between the provinces and territories and the federal government. The last one happened between 2004 and 2014, was a 10-year agreement. And basically it it was agreement that made sure that the provinces and the territories and the federal government were all working towards key areas of improvement in our public health care system. They, you know, they looked at the evidence and they looked, okay, these are some of the troubles that we're having with the public system. We'd like to work on how to fix it over the 10 years. And one of the things they looked at was wait times. They identified five areas, cardiac surgery, hip and knee replacement, some of those things to actually focus on and make changes all across the country. The other thing it did was it set in stone more money for healthcare. Previously, the amount of money going from the federal government in transfers to the provinces had really gone down, been cut. Originally, back when Medicare started, it was a 50-50 cost sharing between mm-hmm. the provinces and the federal government. And by the end of 99, it was actually down to 10.2% from the federal government to the provinces. So this latest health accord, it agreed to a 6% escalator, so 6% more each year from the federal government to the provinces to specifically address these areas where they agreed were the priority for over that 10 years. So that brought the federal funding up to 25%, and that was the amount that had actually been recommended by Romano in his mm-hmm. in his report mm-hmm. back then. And so what it really allowed, coordination and collaboration across the country for the making the kinds of changes that were felt were needed at that time. And it allowed the federal government to have some teeth in enforcing the principles of the Canada Health Act with the provinces, and really made sure that we had a national public health care program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I find it interesting. I mean, poll after poll shows that Canadians consider health one of the biggest issues in the country, and yet there's been very little media coverage of the fact that the health accord is about to expire.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting.
Yep. I guess this is why one of the reasons that the Canadian Health Coalition and the BC Health Coalition and the other provincial health coalitions and the Canadian Doctors for Medicare and the Council of Canadians have really tried to take up this issue and try to bring it to the fore so that people in Canada really know what's being done to their public health care system. And, the polls are really high, 94% of people in Canada. And it was identified in the last federal election as, you know, the top issue that people in Canada were thinking about. So mm-hmm. it is important. And we all think it's important. We all recognize the huge impact it would have on our lives if we had to pay out of pocket a lot more than we already have to, but pay out of pocket for all those basic medical things that now are covered by Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we're having to pay for those or if we're having to wait even longer because of problems with the system, then, you know, that's going to cost all of us in money and in suffering and in lives.
So if this isn't renegotiated, what happens to healthcare funding?
What happens? There's a new funding formula. And so instead of, there's two pieces to that. Instead of a guaranteed, predictable amount of money going from the federal government to the provinces, which over the last 10 years was 6% for each year, now the healthcare funding is going to be tied to the GDP, our economic growth. So on slow years, we'll only get transferred 3%. So there's a minimum set at 3%, but anything over that will only happen if there's economic growth more than 3%. Now, it's been quite a long time since we've had growth in Canada of more than 3%.
Yeah.
So that's one piece. That's a huge cut. And as you said, that's $36 billion over the 10 years cut in Canada. And for BC, that works out to be, if the growth rate stays low, if we just get the 3%, that's a 50% cut in the money coming from federal government, the extra money, and $5 billion cut over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money. Then the other piece is, as you said, the equalization payments coming to have and have not provinces from the federal government. It's now going to be just per capita. So the provinces and territories that have a lot of older folks, or the provinces and territories that have a smaller population and they're way more spread out, so it costs more to deliver those services, they're gonna lose a big chunk. And what that means is that the provinces are kind of being told, you guys are left to your own devices to sort it out, to figure out what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so it fragments the whole system and basically leaves us with 14 separate healthcare systems rather than one coordinated federal public healthcare system giving people the same healthcare no matter where you live in Canada. So that, I think, that coordination and that ability or that now inability to really enforce the Canada Health Act because there's not as much money coming from them, so they don't have as much money to enforce with. It could lead to, depending on the provincial government's philosophies and ideas, it could lead to some big changes in our healthcare system.
So there's actions taking place right across the country, rallies. What's happening here in the Lower Mainland?
There's three rallies that I know about here in the Lower Mainland. There's one here in Vancouver they're all at MP's offices. So this one's at Nina Grewal's office on 6404 Victoria Drive. That's at 9 o'clock this morning. Then there's two others in the Lower Mainland.
That one's Wei Young's office.
Oh, sorry, Wei Young's office.
Yeah.
Sorry. And in Surrey, it's Nina Grewal's office.
Yeah.
Sorry. And in Richmond, it's Alice Wong's office. Yes, that's right. Vancouver, Wei Young's office, 6404 Victoria Drive at 9. Yeah. And then Richmond and Surrey. And then there's a bunch more all across BC as well.
Yeah, well, that's exciting. Maybe just as we running out of time, but this is always a hard question to put forward when we're running out of time.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that it seems like for the last whole number of years, we've been trying to defend the status quo or even just fighting to lessen the cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And what about fighting for a vision for a better, more universal and accessible healthcare system?
Yeah, very important. In fact, that's really how we make our system more cost-effective, more efficient, and actually we'll be able to afford it. And then at the same time, we'll be able to actually address the types of illnesses that people in Canada have nowadays. It's not so much an infectious disease acute care system anymore. It's lots about chronic disease, home and community care, needing a national pharmacare system, needing a national home and community care program so that we can address these areas that are not covered by Medicare and that are the areas where the costs are really going up. So very important to be fighting for improvements to our public system because that's where we'll actually make the most gains and it'll be the most fair and the most cost effective.
Yeah. Well, there's so much more I'd like to talk about.
Well, we can
with
do it
you,
again sometime.
But yeah, we should. We shouldn't wait for a National Day of Action to talk to you about this. And thanks so much,
that's
Rachel.
Right. Yeah, thanks, Jane.
All right.
Bye.
That was Rachel Tutt from the BC Health Coalition.
Well, that's our show for Democracy North, the best interviews, headlines, and music from this week on Media Mornings. I'm David Ball. You can find us at w2media.ca/thisweek. Thank you for listening.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
The landscape of change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings, weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
and podcasting at w2media.ca.